are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I'd like to start with some words from the Torah. It's usually how I begin this program. Commentary by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks. And the Parsha of the week is Parsha Naso. He titles this, The Blessing of Love. He says, at 176 verses, Naso is the longest of all the Parshas. Yet one of its most moving passages, and the one that has had the greatest impact over the course of history, is very short indeed, and is known by almost every Jew, namely the priestly blessings. The Lord said to Moses, Tell Aaron and his sons, Thus shall you bless the Israelites. Say to them, May the Lord bless you and protect you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Let them set my name on the Israelites, and I will bless them. That's from Numbers chapter 6, verse 23 through 27, and that is Parsha Naso. This is among the oldest of all prayer texts. It was used by the priests in the temple. It is said today by the Kohanim in the reader's repetition of the Amidah in Israel every day, in most of the diaspora only on festivals. It is used by parents as they bless their children on Friday night. It's often said to the bride and groom under the chuppah. It's the simplest and most beautiful of all blessings. It also appears in the oldest of all biblical texts that have physically survived until today. In 1979, the archaeologist Gabriel Barke was examining ancient burial caves in Ketef Hinnom, outside the walls of Jerusalem, in the area now occupied by the Menachem Begin Heritage Center. A 13-year-old boy who was assisting Barke discovered that beneath the floor of one of the caves was a hidden chamber. There, the group discovered almost 1,000 ancient artifacts, including two tiny silver scrolls no more than an inch long. They were so fragile, it took 3 years to work out a way of unrolling them without causing them to disintegrate. Eventually, the scrolls turned out to be kemayot, amulets containing, among other things, the priestly blessings. Scientifically dated to the 6th century before the Common Era, the age of Jeremiah in the last days of the First Temple, they are 4 centuries older than the most ancient of biblical texts known previously, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Today, the amulets can be seen in the Israel Museum, testimony to the ancient connection of Jews to the land and the continuity of Jewish faith itself. What gives the priestly blessings their power is their simplicity and their beauty. They have a strong rhythmic structure. The lines contain 3, 5, and 7 words respectively. In each, the second word is the Lord. In all 3 verses, the first part refers to an activity on the part of God. Bless, make his face shine, and turn his face toward. The second part describes the effect of the blessing on us, giving us protection, grace, and peace. They also travel inward, as it were. The first verse, May the Lord bless you and protect you, refers, as the commentators note, to material blessings, sustenance, physical health, and so on. The second, May the Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you, refers to a moral blessing. Chen, grace, is what we show to other people and they to us. It is interpersonal. Here we are asking God to give some of His grace to us and others so that we can live together without the strife and envy that can so easily poison relationships. The third is the most inward of all. There is a lovely story about a crowd of people who have gathered on a hill by the sea to watch a great ship pass by. A young child is waving vigorously. One of the men in the crowd asks him why. He says, "I'm waving so the captain of the ship can see me and wave back." "But," said the man, "the ship is far away, and there is a crowd of us here. What makes you think the captain can see you?" "Because," said the boy, "the captain of the ship is my father. He'll be looking for me among the crowd." That's roughly what we mean when we say, "May the Lord turn His face toward you." There are over 7 billion, maybe 8 billion now living on this earth. What makes any of us more than a face in the crowd, a wave in the ocean, a grain of sand on the shore? The fact that we are God's children, He is our parent, He turns His face towards us. He cares. The God of Abraham is not a mere force of nature, or even all the forces of nature combined. A tsunami does not pause to ask who its victims will be. There is nothing personal about an earthquake or a tornado. The word Elohim means something like the force of forces, the cause of causes, the totality of all scientifically discoverable laws. It refers to those aspects of God that are impersonal. It also refers to God in His attribute of justice, since justice is essentially impersonal. But the name we call Hashem, the name used in the priestly blessings and in almost all the priestly texts, is God as He relates to us as individuals, each with our unique configuration of hopes and fears, gifts and possibilities. Hashem is the aspect of God that allows us to use the word you. He is the God who speaks to us and who listens when we speak to Him. How this happens, we do not know, but that it happens is central to Jewish faith. That we call God Hashem is the transcendental confirmation of our significance in the scheme of things. We matter as individuals because God cares for us as a parent for a child. That, incidentally, is one reason why the priestly blessings are all in the singular, to emphasize that God blesses us not only collectively, but also individually. One life, said the sages, is like a universe. Hence the meaning of the last of the priestly blessings, the knowledge that God turns His face toward us, that we are not just an indiscernible face in a crowd, but that God relates to us in our uniqueness and singularity, is the most profound and ultimate source of peace. Competition, strife, lawlessness, and violence come from the psychological need to prove that we matter. We do things to prove that I'm more powerful or richer or more successful than you. I can make you fear. I can bend you to my will. I can turn you into my victim, my subject, my slave. All of these things testify not to faith, but to a profound failure of faith. Faith means that I believe that God cares about me. I'm here because He wanted me to be here. The soul He gave me is pure. Even though I'm like the child on a hill watching the ship pass by, I know that God is looking for me, waving to me as I wave to Him. That is the most profound inner source of peace. We do not need to prove ourselves in order to receive a blessing from God. All we need to know is that His face is turned towards us. When we are at peace with ourselves, we can begin to make peace with the world. So the blessings become longer and deeper, from the external blessing of material goods to the interpersonal blessing of grace between ourselves and others, to the most inward of them all, The peace of mind that comes when we feel that God sees us, hears us, holds us in his everlasting arms. One further detail of the priestly blessings is unique, namely the blessing that the sages instituted to be said by the Kohanim over the mitzvah. Blessed are you, who has made us holy with the holiness of our own, and has commanded us to bless his people Israel with love. It is the last word, ahava, that is unusual. It appears in no other blessing over the performance of a command. It seems to make no sense. Ideally, we should fulfill all the commands with love, but an absence of love does not invalidate any other command. In any case, the blessing over the performance of a command is a way of showing that we are acting intentionally. There was an argument between the sages as to whether mitzvot, that means commandments, in general, require intention, kavanah, or not. But whether they do or not, making a blessing beforehand shows that we do have the intention to fulfill the command. But intention is one thing, emotion is another. Surely what matters is that the Kohanim recite the blessing and God will do the rest. What difference does it make whether they do so in love or not? The commentators wrestle with this question. Some say that the fact that the Kohanim are facing the people when they bless means that they are like the cherubim in the tabernacle, whose faces were turned to one another as a sign of love. Others change the word order. They say that the blessing really means, who has made us holy with the holiness of Aaron, and with love has commanded us to bless his people Israel. Love here refers to God's love for Israel, not that of the Kohanim. However, it seems to me that the explanation is this. The Torah explicitly says that though the Kohanim say the words, it is God who sends the blessing. Let them put my name on the Israelites, and I will bless them. Normally, when we fulfill a mitzvah, we are doing something. But when the Kohanim bless the people, they are not doing anything in and of themselves. Instead, they are acting as channels through which God's blessings flow into the world and into our lives. Only love does this. Love means that we are focused not on ourselves, but on another. Love is selflessness. And only selflessness allows us to be a channel through which flows a force greater than ourselves. The love that, as Dante said, moves the sun and the other stars. The love that brings new life into the world. To bless, we must love. And to be blessed is to know that we are loved by the one vaster than the universe who nonetheless turns his face towards us as a parent to a beloved child. To know that is to find true spiritual peace. Well, there we have Rabbi Yonatan Sacks and his commentary on the Parsha of the Week, Parsha Naso, the blessing of love. Well, I don't know if how many of you are familiar with the musician Roger Waters, but he's got his following, and he's kind of a modern rockster, you might say, and he's an international performer. And he recently performed in Berlin just about a week or so ago. And his performances, well, let's just say he's an anti-Semite. And it comes through in his performances. He's a severe critic of Israel and basically just doesn't like anything about Jews or Israel. Well, okay. But he gave a performance in Berlin last week, and it was something to see, apparently. This is an article by Melanie Phillips. She titles it, Jew Hatred Struts the Stage in Berlin. She says this obscene spectacle staged by Roger Waters exposes the moral vacuum in Holocaust memorializing. What does she mean by that? Well, she said the unspeakable performance by Roger Waters in Berlin last week crossed a number of new red lines, even for him. The former Pink Floyd guitarist has long been infamous for his venomous attacks on Israel and his anti-Semitic remarks. Few, though, could ever have imagined that he would be allowed to stage his obscene performance at Berlin's Mercedes-Benz Arena. As described on the German website Belltower, Waters displayed the names of people supposedly killed because of their identity. In an odious comparison, Anne Frank, who was indeed murdered because she was a Jew, was displayed as equivalent to Shireen Abu Akleh, the Al Jazeera journalist shot dead while covering clashes between Israeli troops and Palestinian gunmen in Jenin. Dressed in a Waffen-SS uniform, under fascist-style banners hanging from the roof, Waters pretended to fire on the audience with a dummy rifle. When he exchanged this for a keffiyeh, in an unsubtle reference to Israel and the Palestinian Arabs, the giant LED screen flashed up, effing bombing people in their homes, effing the occupation. You can't have occupation and human rights. In a speech bubble displayed on that screen, a fragment of dialogue channeled Jewish conspiracy theory by suggesting that the world was controlled by a cabal of wealthy individuals who were pulling the strings. The diabolical spectacle of Jew hatred received a standing ovation from the audience, and this happened in Berlin, the very epicenter of the Shoah, the Holocaust. Many who visit Berlin speak about the impressive or the moving Holocaust memorial there. The fact that Waters could nevertheless stage this obscenity in that very city shows how thinking has become badly skewed. There is now an unprecedented amount of Holocaust memorializing and education in the West. Yet, the Shoah is nevertheless routinely misappropriated, trivialized, and demeaned. Words like Nazi, fascism, and Holocaust are now used to describe a dizzying range of presumed social ills. Meanwhile, verbal and physical attacks on Jews are becoming ever more frequent and brazen. There are several reasons for this frightening trend, but Holocaust memorializing has itself played an unwitting part. The demonization of the Jews is, of course, a never-ending hatred, as is the corresponding impulse to deny Jewish suffering. At the core of the form it takes today lies moral relativism, the replacement of objective truth by personal opinion, feelings, and emotion. Relativism means no one's values or status can be higher or lower than anyone else's. There can be no hierarchy of suffering, so Jews can never be allowed to make the justifiable claim that the Jewish people are unique, or that anti-Semitism is unique, or that the Nazi genocide of the Jews was unique. Of course, this so-called equal status merely produces an inverted hierarchy in which good and bad, truth and lies, victim and victimizer are reversed. That's one reason why, in the minds of progressives, for whom relativism is a kind of faith, Israel is an oppressor and its Palestinian attackers are its victims. That's why such progressives can't acknowledge that the fate of Israeli victims of Palestinian terrorism is in a different moral universe from the fate of the Palestinians. That's why CNN chief international anchor Christian Amanpour misrepresented the point-blank murder of Lucy Dee and her daughters by Palestinian terrorists in the disputed territories of Judea and Samaria as a shootout. Only one side did any shooting. and why Amanpour's belated and lame attempt at an apology altering shootout to the scarcely less distorted shooting merely compounded the offense. It's why Waters so disgustingly equated Anne Frank with Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed not because she was a Palestinian American, but because she put herself in harm's way by standing in the middle of a firefight. And unfortunately, this most immoral equivalence has now become embedded into the much Holocaust education and memorializing, which equate the genocide of the Jews with other genocides. In his book, The End of the Holocaust, Alvin Rosenfeld observed that the Anne Frank story has been reframed to articulate the need to overcome racism and homophobia, prevent mass murder, and promote tolerance and kindness. Jews like Anne Frank, however, were wiped out not because of a lack of tolerance or kindness or through prejudice, but because of a derangement beyond comprehension directed at the Jewish people. In Mosaic Magazine, 2016, Edward Rothstein wrote that Holocaust museums flinched from emphasizing the uniqueness of Jewish suffering. No such museum, he observed, could seemingly be complete without invoking other 20th century genocides in Rwanda, Darfur, or Cambodia. If we are all guilty, though, then no one is guilty. More balefully still, if everyone can be a Nazi, so too can the Jews. Holocaust universalism has thus led directly to the demonization of Israel by people claiming to be anti-racist. In Britain, this is one reason why there have been strenuous objections to the Holocaust Memorial and Education Center that the government wants to construct in a small park next to the Houses of Parliament. The project has been derailed by the late discovery of a planning law that forbids any such construction in this park, a law that the government is determined to overturn. Aside from environmental objections, significant concerns have long been expressed that the message to be delivered by this center will relativize and thus devalue the Holocaust. These objections have been brushed aside by the government and the project's backers in the Jewish community leadership. However, the government itself has now given the game away by acknowledging that the main purpose of this center is not to commemorate the genocide of the Jews. As Housing Minister Baroness Scott disclosed earlier this month, its aim is to ensure that the story of what happened in the Holocaust resonates with the public. And how will it do that? By denying the unique nature of the Jewish genocide. The content will also address genocides in Cambodia, Rwanda, Bosnia, and Darfur, she said. This drew a furious response from one of the leading opponents of the project, Baroness Deitch, who said it would demote the Shoah. Deitch, who is Jewish and whose late father, historian Joseph Frankl, fled the Nazis, said, it would prompt generalities about hate and intolerance and would drain the presentation of the Shoah from its anti-Semitic origins dating back thousands of years. She went on, they're going to put forward the message that if you see something bad going on, you must not be a bystander. If it's just don't be a bystander, I don't see how that helps people understand anti-Semitism and the plight of the Jews. Deitch was backed by Gary Mond, chairman of the National Jewish Assembly, who said, the main concern is that there must be no dilution to the principle that the Holocaust was totally unique and incomparable. But that message will be utterly diluted by this proposed memorial. The government is being egged on by Jewish community leaders who refuse to get the point. Instead, they have bullied objectors to the project and vilified them as, can you guess, anti-Semites, despite the fact that a number of them are Jews. These leaders are thus weaponizing anti-Semitism to drive through a project that will instrumentalize anti-Semitism in order to deliver a message that will betray the memory of Jews murdered in the Shoah by diminishing their unique fate. Universalizing the Holocaust has happened for two reasons. The non-Jewish world wants to share the protected moral status of being victims of the greatest crime in history by claiming other evils are just as bad. Diaspora Jews, desperate not to be viewed as different, are terrified of asserting Jewish uniqueness, even over this. Meanwhile, a depraved anti-Semite struts the stage in Berlin. Has that happened before? I think so. Well, there you have Melanie Phillips, who is a British journalist, broadcaster, and author. She writes a weekly column for the Jewish News Syndicate, and she is a columnist for the Times of London. Jew hatred struts the stage in Berlin. Okay, let's turn to another essay here. I think we have time to do this. This I thought was interesting. This essay is entitled Why Judaism? It's by a writer, Antonio Garcia Martinez. And what it is a description of secularism, modern secularism, and religious belief, and a comparison of them. In one case, it's Judaism. In another case, it's the secular society in which we all live. He says, "You will watch your parents die and be buried. You will watch your newborn child emerge in a messy circus of heaving grunts and high-pitched wailing. You will watch your dreams and projects dashed, only to wake the next day and greet the fruits of your failure anew and cobble a life out of them all the same. You will punctuate the cavalcade of events with moments of transcendent meaning that will linger in memory like fading signposts during that final moment, your death. Navigating that journey without a religious tradition is like trying to cross open country without a path. You can do so, but you'll do lots of stumbling and very likely lose your way. Trying to get through dense woods, a serious depression, the death of a loved one, without a marked trail requires the most arduous labor for the merest of progress. Furthermore, if you tackle these wilds in their raw and uncleared state, you will almost certainly do so alone. Going off trail means a hard, solitary journey, while the marked trail involves communal groups headed in your same direction. What some might describe as a cultural rut, some time-worn lane that limits movement, might just be the only thing that guides you through this daunting wilderness of life, whose many paths all end at the same destination. To do it yourself, your own world of life signifiers, you have to think you can improve on a bar mitzvah as a coming-of-age ritual, on the Sabbath, the Shabbos, as a form of digital detox, and on tshuva, as a way to grapple with your guilt, or analogs in other religions. Many do, of course, and every trendy San Franciscan has their personal regimen of special diets, meditation schedules, intermittent fasts, escapes to nature, a canon of mimetic culture drawn from their online feeds, a smattering of trendy texts that inform their values, and some slew of Netflix shows that serve as cultural touch points with others in their cohort. This is all in keeping with the current liberal project's moral goal, which is creating lives devoid of any unchosen obligation and absolutely rife with chosen identities of fanciful and recent coinage. The problem is that it's the unchosen obligations, or the obligations chosen but whose downstream responsibilities cannot be unchosen, that will give us the only real meaning in life, family, children, our hometowns, our childhoods, our ethnic identity, if we have one, or the chosen but undoable commitments, marriage, joining the military, that company we start, religious faith. These are all the defining obligations where ourselves really play out. If I were to go back and say one thing to my younger self as a warning from the future, it's this. The eventual cost of optionality in life, all the commitments you don't make to preserve your ability to instantly change course, is usually not worth the upside that optionality eventually produces. And even when that optionality is rich indeed, and I know a thing or two about the exploding value of literal financial options, your commitment to that remunerative course, fully cognizant of your wider obligations, will serve you better than the anxious FOMOing of the hyper-optimizer, which is a long way of saying at some point you do have to choose a hill to die on, because if you don't, you won't really ever have lived at all. Here, I attempt to lay out why you should also do so, and why I choose the Jewish hill that I did. Every society needs a metaphysics that allows it to have moral and political conversations with itself. Liberalism's preferred metaphysical framework of utilitarianism, in effect, FX by Excel spreadsheet, is at best a simplistic hack that illuminates some trade-off, much as microeconomics can inform the pricing of Starbucks' various coffee sizes. That's assuming society can even do the hard math of exchanging one type of human well-being, or even entire lives, against others in a rational way. It's more than a little pathetic watching an avowedly atheist materialist society whose epistemology ends at empiricism, play at metaphysics. It makes them suck, even at empiricism, as reality must be warped to suit whatever non-empirical argument they're incapable of expressing any other way. Consider the epistemic chaos in the United States as every side tries to win with COVID and show that their side's interpretation, vaccine mandates, mask mandates, no mandates, ivermectin, zero COVID, my cousin's friends, swollen balls, whatever, aligns with empirical reality, which is the only mode of reasoning about even immaterial questions. Thus, the constant citation of half-assed studies, many later corrected or retracted, attempting to marshal evidence for what are effectively moral or religious stances. The questions we should be asking are the ones that secular modernity doesn't even possess the moral vocabulary to discuss anymore. For example, do we sacrifice the old for the sake of educating the young during a pandemic? What is the duty of the citizen to the state? And does that include collective sacrifice like vaccination? What is the duty of the state to the citizen in presenting policy as truthfully as possible, rather than as a purportedly noble lie? To what common good should the state intervene in our lives? Toward what common good should we all be striving? The answers to these questions are not to be found in any iffy study those doing online COVID battle could cite. And even our wider political culture is bereft of any coherent philosophical platform. Figures like John Rawls and Robert Nozick once provided something like a cogent political worldview, though it took Rawls several hundred pages of Harvard-level disquisition and veils of ignorance analogies to restate Kant's categorical imperative in Matthew chapter 7, verse 12. But that's all gone now, and there's nobody even remotely in the position of a Rawls. For the first time in my life, no political faction in the West has anything like a generative vision of the future. Your point on the current political spectrum is defined by the year to which you'd like somehow to magically return, society. 2009, an Obamaite. 1952, conservative. 1984, a Reagan nostalgist. And so it goes. It may well be the case that liberalism is unsustainable without a real illiberal antagonist. If none exists, one will be invented. Each political side perpetually assures us the other side is prepping for tyranny at any moment. The thought that our government, which bungled both a pandemic response and a war against a medieval religious sect, would be capable of iron-fisted autocracy in a modern country of 330 million seems, well, almost wishfully ambitious in its fear. To the extent there's anything like a forward-looking plotline in our national conversation, it's the old fallbacks of every post-Christian society, in a tizzy of panicked confusion, millenarian brooding about a coming apocalypse, and revivalist fervor around some utopian project or another. Beyond the latest episode in the political telenovela, Russiagate, QAnon, what else do we talk about other than the zealous demands of wokeness and the perils of climate change? Leaving the elevated realm of politics for the more quotidian one of personal morality and rule of law, matters aren't going to get much better. Consider for a moment the Noahide laws of Judaism, the basic moral principles thought to apply to all humanity. In addition to the usual proscriptions around murder, theft, and adultery, we have a very unique one, the requirement to establish courts of justice to adjudicate human behavior. Without that, in the Jewish mind, humanity would live in brutish savagery. How does our society rate now, today, against the Noahide laws? What are our courts of justice? Nowadays, our judges are mostly narcissistic sociopaths gaming Twitter's engagement algorithms to get someone fired over some perceived moral lapse. This week, it was over another confused encounter involving dog walking. This week's online Hester Prynne was instantly fired by a corporate management happy to consider an online mob's verdict as binding as anything from the Supreme Court. Another such duet of mob outrage coupled with corporate cowardice led to my firing, this is the author, from Apple. That time via the internal vector for mob mayhem called Slack. This moral cowardice is ironic in a corporate world suddenly bursting with people with ethics or equity in their job titles. Mostly they're charlatans regurgitating the improvised tropes of whatever faddish academic or corporate cult has sprung up to fill the God-sized hole at the center of liberalism. Meanwhile, politicians advocate for more and more public sacrifice around COVID while skirting their own restrictions, and the only person sitting in jail for the Afghanistan fiasco is the one officer who dared demand accountability for it. There is no real public court of justice or moral code in our modern-day world anymore, and deep down, we all know it. Our current society wouldn't pass the last and arguably most important of Noah's seven laws for minimally civilized behavior. That is, a judicial system, a working justice system. The core problem here is that at the heart of any real political or moral reasoning, if we're being honest with ourselves, we're left pointing at a document or set of principles and arguing by sheer faithful assertion alone. These principles we believe to be true, and we will make decisions of life and death import according to these moral foundations. If you disagree, sorry. We don't have much to talk about, as we simply live in different moral universes. Faced with the secular alternative of bitchy Twitter food fights and cancel culture, I choose to believe there are sterner and wiser judges in this universe than the blue checks of Twitter and people department at companies like Apple. More and more, secular modernity looks like a shaky edifice of convoluted fantasies built over an abyss, and I, for one, am tired of pretending to take it seriously. Those who reject the modern sham and wish to reason seriously about politics or morality must necessarily strike a pose, half pointing, half saluting, towards some set of sacred principles. On the political front, I choose to salute the United States Constitution, so long as we can keep it. On the moral front, I gesture towards the Bible of the Hebrews. We've arrived at a unique point in history where many Americans love nothing more than themselves, and the only functioning organization that touches their lives is a corporation. That's all good and well as a single striver sprinting along our treadmill of an economic system. The above realization takes on a more somber tone when confronted with the only form of immortality available to most of us, and that is our children. Daddy, why is that man living in the bus stop? Daddy, why are you gone working so much? Daddy, can I read this book or watch this show? Daddy, what's this flag I'm holding? Suddenly, questions like these go from the heated but ultimately vain stuff of Twitter threads to daunting conversations with the one thing left in the world you'd sacrifice yourself to save. Those big brown eyes staring at you demand an answer to those questions. Her absolute receptiveness to your answer yokes you with a responsibility to posterity that hedonistic modernity has distracted you from your entire life. What do you put in that mind that will outlast yours? Nowadays, the exercise seems to be less of curating a personal time capsule and more that of a shipwrecked sailor trying to salvage what's worth keeping from a vessel or a society that is foundering on a rocky shore. Much like that sailor would, we agonize over what books and ultimately what stories we choose to salvage and keep on reading and repeating to one another. Consider another example drawn from the Jewish world. Most of the planet commemorates the Holocaust, January 27, the day the Red Army liberated Auschwitz. Every country considers that Holocaust Remembrance Day, except the Jewish State of Israel itself. They commemorate the Holocaust, the Shoah, on the 27th day of the Jewish month of Nisan, the day the Warsaw Ghetto uprising occurred, when poorly armed Jews fought to the death against the Nazi war machine rather than passively submit to annihilation. The nascent state of Israel thought it important to enshrine that as the nation's Holocaust narrative, which is what Yom HaShoah is, rather than a narrative that had Jews passively saved, much too late, by an outside power. As frivolous as they sometimes might seem, the stories we tell ourselves are what we ultimately become as people and a civilization. There is perhaps no more important choice we face as stewards of the present than what we pass on to the future as a shared narrative. We all subconsciously realize that, which is why the debates over the 1619 Project or critical race theory have grown so heated and deafening. With the grim examples of slavery and the Holocaust in mind, let's revisit the question. What then do we put in our children's heads? For me, the choice is very simple. My children are the descendants of Holocaust survivors, refugees from an Islamic revolution, and exiles from two communist revolutions, both Russian and Cuban flavors. The 20th century, in all its turmoil, flows through their veins in the oddest of admixtures. This extended family has seen many a government fall and world implode. Many times in our collective memory, what once seemed like the bedrock firmament of a sane society was soon demolished for a fresh hell of human devising. In a present moment that seems similarly pregnant with change, I'll invite my children to open one of humanity's oldest body of works and once again read aloud. Read about the cunning ruthlessness of Judith, willing to do anything to save her tribe. The self-indulgent hubris of David. The righteous guile of Esther. The genocidal wrath of Jacob's sons avenging the rape of their sister Dinah. The fierce defiance of the Maccabees, hell-bent on saving their traditions. The murderous envy of Cain. The reluctant, bungling leadership of Moses, who somehow managed a spectacular exodus. The smoldering sensuality of the Song of Songs. The evocative verses of Psalms, whose catchphrases litter every Western language. The wailing nostalgia of Lamentations. The all-in loyalty of Ruth. The unshakable faith of Job. The dancing, timbrel-playing triumph of Miriam. The castigating tirades of Jeremiah, the comically inept procrastination of Jonah, and finally, the existential world weariness of Ecclesiastes. All of humanity is there, in all its sublime or squalid expanse. An adult life will be populated by its own personal Bible of Cain's and David's and Esther's. But unlike the epic characters in such timeless works as the Odyssey or Beowulf, or even distant references like Aeschylus or Shakespeare, this gallery of characters populates a still extant, still existing tradition whose adherents sway in collective fervor every Jewish holiday. This very week was Simchas Torah, Hebrew for joy of the Torah. When Jews take the Torah scrolls out of the synagogue's ark and joyfully parade them outdoors, dancing and singing with their scriptures' heavy burdens slung awkwardly on their shoulders. It marks the end of the annual cycle wherein an advancing Torah portion is read aloud every Sabbath, one turn of the scroll at a time until the very end. It is the one Jewish festival not divinely ordained, nor the product of some historical event. This the Jews put on for themselves in their obsessive love for their collective story. And when all the singing and dancing is over, they immediately rewind the scroll and start reading again, as they have for millennia. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. As that scroll is returned to the ark after the reading, the gathered crowd recites, "It is a tree of life to those who hold fast to it." Indeed, it has been a tree of life to a people who made it the foundation of their civilization, a people that stubbornly persist in a world that often wanted nothing less than their total extermination. A world that even now begrudges the Jews the tiny state they perilously safeguard. Stuck in a secular modernity that's lost the plot and that no longer knows what it is or where it's going, I choose to hold fast to that tree of life. I also say, as the loyal convert Ruth once said to Naomi, "Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried." Powerful essay, contrasting the emptiness, the narcissism of modern secular culture with religious tradition. And for our conversation, a Jewish religious tradition. Well, I think we have time for one more. Let me turn to an article by a rabbi. His name is David Zolakowski, and he's a rabbi who has an advice column where people write him questions and he answers it with rather unique perspective that a rabbi has. So here's one about the Jewish tradition. Why kiss a mezuzah? For those of you that may not know what a mezuzah is, it's a little fixture, a tiny little, I say tiny, anywhere from an inch to maybe 3 inches, little thing that's attached on the right side of a door as you enter of a Jewish home, or you see them in synagogues, you see them places like that, wherever there's a Jewish content, there you'll find a mezuzah. And the question, why kiss the mezuzah? Okay, so this reader writes, he wants to understand why some people touch the mezuzah on their doorpost of their homes as they enter or leave. And he says, the mezuzah placed on doorways in Jewish homes holds a piece of parchment containing two selections of verses, Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4 through 9, and Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 13 through 21. This is the Shema prayer, which expresses the unity of God. The verses start with, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, and continue with the commandment to love God with all your heart. The parchment is placed in a small encasement and affixed on the doorposts of a home. The tradition in many Jewish homes is to place one's hand on the mezuzah when passing by, and there are those who then kiss the hand that touched it. What's the source of this custom? The first record of someone touching a mezuzah in this way is found in the Talmud in a story of the famous Roman convert to Judaism, Onkelos, the son of Kalonymus. The Talmud relates that the Roman emperor sent soldiers to bring Onkelos to him. They went, and Onkelos told them verses from the Torah, and they were inspired, and they converted. The emperor sent another group of soldiers telling them not to tell him anything. Onkelos said, Let me tell you something trivial. But inspired by his words, they all converted. The emperor sent another group of soldiers and told them not to discuss anything with him. Well, as they were taking him out of the house, Onkelos saw a mezuzah on the doorway. He stretched out his arm and touched it. Onkelos asked them, What is this that I am touching? The soldiers responded, You tell us. Onkelos explained to them. He explained, It is the custom of the world that the king sits in the inside of the palace, and the guards protect him from the outside. However, with God, his servants are inside their homes, and he protects them from the outside. As the verse says from Psalms, God will protect your departure and your arrival from now and forever. The soldiers were inspired, and they converted, and the emperor did not send any more soldiers. Based on this passage, Rabbi Moses Isserles added in a gloss in the Code of Jewish Law, Some have the custom to place their hand on the mezuzah when they leave their home and say, God will protect your departure. And the same when one enters the home. One should place one's hand on the mezuzah. Why place a hand on the mezuzah? Commentaries explain it reminds you to contemplate the unity of God, as Maimonides writes in his Code of Jewish Law, the Mishneh Torah. A person needs to be very careful in their observance of mezuzah, for it is incumbent on every individual and during the entire day. Through the mezuzah, every time a person enters or leaves his home, he will encounter the unity of God and remember his love for God. Thus, he will awaken from his sleep and recognize his obsession with the vanity of the times. And he will know that there is nothing that lasts eternally, beside for the knowledge of the Creator of the world. Through contemplating this, the person will regain awareness and follow the path of the upright. Rabbi Isaac Luria, known as the Arizal, adds that one should kiss the finger that touched the mezuzah, as if the holiness of the mezuzah transferred to the hand. The Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson of righteous memory, in a 1987 talk, praised the custom of children kissing the mezuzah before going to bed. The Rebbe explained how what a person sees and hears as a child influences him as an adult, and that for children, kissing the mezuzah engraves in them the recognition that there is one God that watches over them and all that is found in their room. There you have it. What's a mezuzah? And why touch it or kiss it as you enter or leave your home? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see we're just about out of time. So I want to thank you for joining me today for readings of interest to the Jewish community and remind you that my name is Michael Wolin. I'd like to wish all of you also a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavuot Tov. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.